Tonight on Arena, Donal Gallagher on his brother Rory's calling card, and we review Circle Mirror Transformation at the Gate Theatre. This Bank Holiday Monday, a new TV documentary, Rory Gallagher Calling Card, will be broadcast on RT1. It features rare, never-before-seen archive and interviews with Rory's closest friends and family, alongside musical legends including Johnny Marr, Brian May and Bob Geldof. It is a portrait of one of the greatest musicians ever to emerge from Ireland. And our guide in the film is his brother and former tour manager, Donal Gallagher, who is in the Sligo studio. But this is Rory Gallagher's calling card.
About where it lands, it'll find you hiding no matter where you stand. It's gonna rain, brother, and it's gonna rain hard when the blues comes calling with his calling card. It ain't too funny when you'd rather die. Ain't no pleasure when that girl don't reply to your love sick letter that you wrote in tears about so bad for a million years. Watch our brother.
Calling Card, Rory Gallagher's 1976 album, and the name of the new documentary to be broadcast on RT1 on Monday. Rory Gallagher's Calling Card, the documentary, is fronted by his brother Donal Gallagher, who joins me now from the Sligo studio. You're only 2 years younger than your brother Rory, so your life really mirrored his from, you know, early years in Ballyshannon, then to Cork. What was it like revisiting these moments, Donal?
Quite cathartic. A real trip down memory lane. I was born in Derry. Rory was born in Ballyshannon 2 years before me, so our father was from Derry, so from Ballyshannon into Derry, and then my mother from Cork. We ultimately, she took us back down to the welcoming arms of Cork.
And can you remember that musical awakening that Rory had? Did you share in that as well? You were close brothers.
Yes, I mean, Rory got the gene that bypassed me, because our father was an Ulster champion piano accordion player. In fact, he had his own Cayley Dance Orchestra called the Inishowen Cayley Dance Orchestra. That was before the war, but which upset everybody's lives at that time, and that kind of ended his career.
And then Rory, was it music he listened to, or was it that part of that tradition that his father would have bred in you, and then music that you were listening to on radio and through records?
Yeah, a culmination of everything. And our mother was a fantastic singer, and she could sing opera or the hits of the day. But largely, I think the awakening was in Derry itself. Because post-war, you still had the American forces and using the port of Derry, because the Cold War had started, and that was the main port for the American forces. So they'd transmit right across the river. You couldn't avoid but hearing it coming through the early radio systems, the early crystal systems. And Rory would, like a kid would surf the internet now, Rory would find the stations that he wanted to listen to. And particularly, he'd listen to the Voice of America. They had a jazz hour. So initially, his introduction was into jazz. But obviously, in the streets, he was hearing traditional music, which my father played as well. So it was an amalgam of then the early days of rock and roll coming through, and Lonnie Donegan and Chris Barber. So it was quite a mixture.
And then you moved to Cork, and with the troubles happening in Northern Ireland, it must have been an easier place for you as boys to grow up.
Well, the troubles, the tensions were there, were always there. The border had just sort of been, we moved down in the 50s.
Oh, right, yes.
And then ultimately went back up to, in 67, to Rory based his band Taste in Belfast. So we were in Belfast 67 as the whole thing really began to turn sour, and then into the 70s. By then we'd moved to London. But Cork was quite a different setting at that time, because we lived in McCurtain Street in the heart of the city at my grandmother's premises. She had a public house there. So it was quite interesting, because you had all the people returning from America in the summer, and a different kind of musical take in the place. So, it, you know, between what you could get on RTE and Luxembourg, that's where Rory was then getting his music. And it wasn't the carrot for Rory to go down to Cork, was that they would buy him a guitar. So that's where Rory got his first real guitar.
All right, and tell us about that, about going to the shop, seeing the guitar and wanting it.
Well, initially he got a very basic acoustic guitar, and he just practiced day and night. That's when I kind of lost my brother. And if for a time at school, instead of going out to play football, he was practicing all the time. And then by 15, he wanted to form a group, but couldn't find sort of like-minded musicians. So he responded to an ad for a show band called the Fontana, who were looking for a guitarist. And he pretended he was just going on 18 when he was actually 15. So he got the audition and joined the Musicians Federation as well, whilst going to school, trying to do his Leaving Cert. And he managed to do both.
Now, it was when he set up Taste that you became very involved with him, as maybe he didn't recognise you as the manager, but you were very much a managerial role from early on.
Yeah, well, he'd gone off the show bands off to Europe, and actually was in Hamburg and Spain and various places. So his kind of position in the city, I was doing DJ in the clubs, that whole new group scene had emerged. So I was active in that scene, and used to tell the club manager about my brother, that he could form a group and have a great band. So he then came back and he formed a band, Taste, as you say. And some of the first gigs were at the club where I worked. So it kind of, I always wanted to play, but I couldn't. So the best next job was to be the road manager.
Now, as I say, there's contributions from Johnny Marr of the Smiths, Brian May of Queen. And it's just very interesting what Brian May has to say about the guitar playing of Rory Gallagher. And we listen to a clip now.
There's a great thing on the Boards. You know, I bought the On the Boards album having seen him at the Marquee. He's playing away and it's quite nice and sort of boogie kind of sound, rhythm sound. And he just stops and you can hear him turn it up and it goes, and you hear that distortion kick in and he goes, and it sings. That's what I wanted. I always thought, that's the sound I want. So I asked him, how do you get the guitar to sing like that? He said, oh, you know, I have this AC30 amp, which I really love. You know, doesn't sound like any other amp. Then I have this little box here, which drives the amp really hard, little treble booster, and that's the sound. That's it. That was his voice, his sound. So I was completely inspired. So it was Rory that gave me my sound, and that's the sound I still have.
That's Brian May of Queen there, talking about the huge influence that Rory had on his playing, and that idea of using that little box that he plugged into the amp, Donal.
Oh, yeah, the treble booster. It's lovely to hear Brian making that contribution, because he had arrived in the same street we lived in on London. So we were all in bedsits, and his band was called Smile. And yeah, you could tell who were the bands by the vans on the street. So that's how it connected. He's a lovely man.
And another person who makes a contribution is Johnny Marr of The Smiths. And he talks about, at the end, which is so poignant, he says that the most important thing was that Rory Gallagher had his brother, you, as his manager.
Well, I'm very flattered. It's nice of Johnny to say that. He's a lovely man.
Rory had a particular, he was quite, even though he was a wonderful stage performer, he could be very introverted and quite stubborn, I think you say, musically, in terms of who he wanted to play with, all around that time when Taste broke up, and then you had to negotiate another record contract for him.
That's quite right, yeah. I mean, in 74, the Rolling Stones wanted him to replace Mick Taylor, and Rory did four nights. But I don't think he felt it was for him, and he just slipped away and off he went to Japan.
How did that go, playing with the Rolling Stones?
Well, he did four nights. Keith Richards wasn't in the best of health, shall we say. And it was Mick Jagger who was trying to get the band back on the road. And Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman were basically musicians in the band. So Mick was trying to drive this through. So Rory at that point was probably the predominant guitarist in Europe, if not the world. So he fitted into the category of replacing Mick Taylor because...
The music,
musically, yeah, musically they sort of fish from the same pool of blues and rock and the same kind of influences. But it's one of the great what-if stories.
Yes, and Rory had a very creative period then in the early 1970s, didn't he? Up to this 1976 when he did Calling Card. Would you say that that was his really... Purple Patch?
In fairness to Rory, I mean, to me, what he did in the 90s was just as valid. I mean, I think youth, you know, particularly from he was 18 when Taste was happening. So I think there's an outpouring, like any of the musicians, be they classical or whatever. I think there's this spring waiting to explode.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. I mean, he couldn't wait to get out on the road, as well as trying to do. I mean, he delivered Polydor Records 6 albums in 4 years. I mean, it was unheard of. I think they were shocked to find that he was already out of contract by 1975. And so then he took a little bit more time in the studio working on the albums. And so it, you know, and each album became longer and longer. So, but certainly there was quite a flourish in the 70s period.
When would you say that his music, that just musical styles and tastes changed? So therefore, when we get into the 90s, even though he is still a wonderful stage performer and he is in demand in Europe and in various venues in Ireland, there isn't that hunger for the kind of music he's offering.
Well, Rory never... ever. He didn't release singles for a start. He didn't want to be part of the top of the Pops Brigade. He ploughed his own furrow.
Yes.
And he created a kind of his own classic style of rock. And he stuck with that. And particularly, he was passionate about blues music and the musicians themselves. And in fact, several of his songs were tributes to people like Alexis Corner, Chris Barber, Clifton Chenier. He was always writing about other musicians. So he never liked the kind of rat race of what's the latest single into the charts. So, and which was frustrating for me and for record companies, that, you know, he wasn't creating milestones for his albums.
And Rory died all too young. And what would you say, and what do you think people will get from this documentary in terms of the legacy he has? I mean, you have such wonderful contributors saying how important he was musically.
Yeah, well, without trying to be a pun about it, they'll get a taste of Rory. In fairness, trying to squeeze a lifetime of his music into a 52-minute segment, you know, all you can do is, highlight it, and hopefully people will search further themselves. And but I think it's certainly for somebody coming to it for the first time or to his music for the first time, we'll learn something about his greatness.
Well, you're a wonderful guide to your brother's life and his music, Donal Gallagher. Thank you so much.
And
thank you, Donal. Brian Redden's documentary, Rory Gallagher, Calling Card, will be streamed on RT1 at 6:30 this Monday, June the 3rd. And Donal will be appearing at the 20th Rory Gallagher International Festival in Ballyshannon this weekend, where we'll take part in a Q&A with Dave Fanning tomorrow at the Rory Gallagher Theatre. And Dave Fanning also features in the documentary. Further details at rorygallagherfestival.com. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Conceived back in 2008 in the United States, the award-winning play Circle Mirror Transformation is now having its Irish debut at the Gate Theatre. It's what you might call a meta play, as we are presented with four actors who come together once a week for 6 weeks in a drama class run by a woman called Marty. Marty runs her class through various acting and dramatic exercises, which over time causes the group to reveal themselves. Set in a small town in Vermont, the play is written by Annie Baker, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and it is directed by the Gates artistic director Roisin McBrien. Marty Ray, Richard Cooper, Imogen Dole and Hazel Dupe play the actors, while Niamh Cusack plays the group leader. Marty Helmini has been to see Circle Mirror Transformation and she's with me now in studio. So Niamh Cusack plays Marty. She's an enthusiastic drama leader. And who are the people there? Professional actors or people who just want to come to an acting class?
No, they are complete amateurs, really, or beginners possibly, and they're in a small town in Vermont, and they sign up for a 6 week summer drama course in their local community center, and so they are, you know, it's the how those four people, five people, end up together is kind of random almost, you know, and they, I think, are surprised that they're not being handed a script and actually rehearsing a play, so they never rehearse a play. They do a lot of improvisation and various games.
And the name of the play, this Circle Mirror Transformation, that is
It's a game of going around in a circle and adding to what the person before you has said, and also mirroring or reflecting back their gestures and movements. So it comes at a point in the play that it has a particular significance. But as the weeks go by, the students in the class, we call them, their resistance kind of breaks down. Initially, they are very dubious about the whole thing. So there's a lot of humor in bringing these people together in an enclosed space week after week. And that's where the whole play is set, in this studio.
And I guess these people have to be very different kind of personalities and have ways of hitting off each other in difficult and funny ways.
Yes. Yeah, so really, the whole play is a study in the relationships between them and how they interact, and you know, two characters are instantly attracted to each other. That's Schultz, played by Marty Ray, and Teresa. So they're both recently separated, they've had breakdowns, they're a bit vulnerable, and they start a very short-lived shall we say, affair, if you call it that even. And then the other, there's another couple, and that's Marty, the facilitator, and her husband, James, played by Richard. So they're a married couple. And what emerges over the weeks is that there are problems in their relationship. There are tensions arise, and some of them emerge through the games that they play.
Okay, so how is this staged then? You go into the Gate Theatre and are you watching the usual proscenium march and the action going on?
No, it's actually in Traverse, which means that it's in the middle of the gate, which is great to see. It looks totally different. So the audience sits on both sides of the stage. So the actors have to carefully play on the left and on their right, and also in the sort of in the round almost. And there are two mirrors at either end of Paul Keoghan's set. So we see them from lots of different angles, which is a really good device. I mean, it's kind of normal, a studio space in like having mirrors like that, a wall of mirrors in, say, a dance studio. But it works really, really well. And so when we look across over the actors at the other side of the gate, we see a bank of audience members. So there's a mirroring going on there as well. So it's very simple, but we're very ingeniously staged.
And then how complex and how uncomfortable, if that's the right word, does the play get for the actors and for the audience members?
Not for the audience members, not uncomfortable. I think what comes up for the characters as through these games is that they reveal things about themselves, and emotions rise to the surface, and they tell each other things that they probably had never intended to. And then there is a scene towards the end where they are asked by Marty to reveal something private. And so I think the question there is, has she crossed over some sort of emotional boundary? As you know, and the person who's most affected by that is actually Marty herself. So that's a very interesting process. So it's very much about how much do they trust her? And, you know, she spends a lot of time developing their trust. And they all get to know each other very, very well. And I suppose what happens is that they change in different ways as a result of these weeks that they spend together. And we see all that happening. It's very absorbing. It's, you know, you have to pay close attention to nuance of face and gesture and what's actually happening between the characters.
As I named them there, there's a great troupe of actors there. Niamh Cusack, obviously, Richard Cooper and Marty Ray, and then Imogen Dole and Hazel Doop.
Yes, they're absolutely fantastic, I have to say. I mean, so it really depends on the cast's ability to hold the attention of the audience, because a lot of it is in nuance. There's a lot of very subtle stuff going on, interaction. And, you know, the cast are absolutely excellent. I mean, in terms of the characters, I would say that Schultz, played by Marty Ray, who's a divorced furniture maker, carpenter, and Marty, the dramatist, we get to know them probably the best. And their scenes are really beautifully done. And Marty Ray has just this kind of vulnerability as Schultz. He's very open, you know, he's kind of emotionally raw. But we see him change over the weeks as well. And then the marital tension between Marty and her husband is really very well observed. And there's a lot of anger comes up between them.
So the director here is the artistic director of the Gate Theatre, Roisin McBrien.
Yes.
So what is she saying by putting on a play like this? You know, it's an American play, a play from 2008. What would you see the reason for that choice?
Well, I mean, Annie Baker is a really acclaimed playwright. I mean, she's won the Pulitzer, and, you know, and her work hasn't been seen in Ireland very much. I've seen a couple of her plays at the National Theatre in London. And so it's great to see the Gate staging international work, and, you know, which is its tradition. And so I think,
yes, and we don't get that. I mean, obviously there's the theatre festivals and the Galway Arts Festival and other international festivals, but I suppose we don't get that opportunity to see Irish theatres putting on
a contemporary American, you know, because, and she also staged Fun Home, the musical. So, yeah, you know, and that, so I think it's lovely to see the ambition of that and giving audiences a chance to see work that otherwise you'd have to travel for. And it's a very good production. It's carefully staged. It's possibly a little slow in the beginning, but it's the attention to the emotional I suppose, flickers and ripples through the group is very, very well held. And so it's a lovely production. It's not for everyone, because I think people might think it's a bit slight, but I didn't think it was slight. I found it very gripping.
Mm. It sounds like something you'd have great conversations about, the different characters afterwards.
Yes. And what was going on, and particularly in some of the games, because they are open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. So there is ambiguity. But there's no doubt that things actually do change during the course of the 6 weeks, and things do happen. And I don't want to spoil that.
Do you know if the play was improvised itself to come about, or did she?
Well, I mean, Annie Baker has an acting background, and she's a director. So I would think that it definitely draws on her own experience, you know. But a lot of actors in the audience would recognize some of those games. They're pretty particularly well known in improvisation. So there was a lot of laughter of recognition in the audience. Now, that's not to say that it's really a play about theatre. It isn't. It's actually a play about being alive, you know.
Yes, because I was thinking of that when I was thinking about the play, and I thought, no, it is. It's not about theatre. It's not that meta that it's about itself. It's more using it as a way of exploring human relationships.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, don't be put off by that idea that it's all about in jokes. It isn't really. That's just a sort of a vehicle. And I think it's clear that she loves playwrights like Chekhov, you know, that intention to humour, but also great heartbreak and sadness, and that those things can coexist in her work. And she's actually adopted for the stage Uncle Vanya. So, you know, there's an affinity there. So that gives you a sense of sometimes it can be slow and poignant, but there's some great moments of laughter.
So I think you're recommending this, but not for everybody.
I'm recommending it, and I really enjoyed it.
All right. Helen Meaney, thank you so much. Circle Mirror Transformation is at the Gate Theatre Dublin until the 30th of June. Further details from gatetheatre.ie. It's Friday evening, so it's time for album reviews, and we have four major releases to listen to this week. The Ivor Novello winning artist Bat for Lashes, aka Natasha Khan, released her sixth record, The Dream of Delphi, as she moves into a new phase, creatively and personally. Richard Hawley returns with In This City They Call You Love, inspired by his native Sheffield. Crowded House return with the album Gravity Stairs. It seems the group love Ireland so much they all have Irish passports. And Come As You Are from Niamh Regan, her second album of very personal folk tracks, is presented in a more full band sound. I'm joined by Zara Hederman and Pat Carty, who is also starring in Rory Gallagher's Calling Card. So let's start with Back for Lashes. Yeah. And this is the title track, The Dream of Delphi. So that's The Dream of Delphi, and that's from the album of the same name from Bat for Lashes. Zara, Delphi is the name of her new baby. So, and as I said, she's exploring personal themes here. So obviously motherhood is one of them.
Yeah, and across her career, something that she has done so well is kind of frequently examine different female archetypes. So this is her sixth album. And along the way, you know, you've had albums like Two Sons, The Bride, which is another conceptual album. And as she came to this one, she said, motherhood, I thought would take me away from my art, but it opened me up to this massive world. And even as we hear in that snippet of the opening song, it is expansive, and you have that contrast of the electronic motifs, and then as it gradually kind of develops, those lovely strings and then harp from Mary Lattimore. I've been a huge fan of hers, mainly because with each release she gives something completely different, and she really pushes the boundaries in a kind of similar way to, like, Bjork is one that I came to mind quite a lot. Here it's a lot more sonically experimental, I would say. Like that song there, we hear her beautiful vocals, and she's kind of talking, she's almost like summoning the existence of her child in that song. And as the album progresses, you know, you get songs called The Midwives Have Left Home, and it's all of this kind of chronological document of this time. And I think it, for me, it worked really, really well, even though it is a bit more kind of sparse in her presence.
So just to re-quote what Zara said there about Bat for Lashes, she says, motherhood, I thought, would take me away from my art, but it opened up a massive world. Do you find that in that track?
Well, there's another quote that says, the enemy of art is the pram in the hall. I can't remember off the top of my head who said it. I wasn't crazy about this. Let me say that from the top. I mean, the track we heard there is one of the better ones, I think, on it. There's a single as well called Home, which is a bit more commercial sounding than maybe what Zara's referring to there. And I thought that was pretty good as well. That grew on me. But some of the stuff on this, you mentioned the midwives have left the building and things like that. It's not so much a song as kind of ethereal warbling, you know, fairies dancing under the moonlight, Wiccan kind of stuff almost. And there was another one, I think Breaking Up. You know, there's a lot of instrumentals on this as well. And Breaking Up, it's going along with these soundscapes, these kind of, that's an awful journalistic cliche, but the sound anyway. And it's kind of bland, to be honest with you. And then this 80s kind of saxophone comes in, and it reminded me of some sort of awful movie about executives in LA or something like that.
But you mentioned the pram in the hallway now. I mean, there is a need for, you know, there's always opening for women to talk about that domestic space, and where that domestic space might take you, Zara, might be a very different place.
Yeah, and like there are so many albums about motherhood. Like a recent one I thought of as well was Laura Marling. I think it was Song for Our Daughter. And that's quite an intimate and introspective album, and it's very domestic in its setting. What I really appreciated about this is how expansive it is and how it kind of really turned her world completely upside down. And that, I think, is reflected in the sonics. And even later on, you know, you have a song, Letter to My Daughter, and she said that she kind of imagined this as she was on her deathbed and she's talking to her daughter, and she's saying, you know, your life an echo, my darling, and yes, you are a song. So that kind of, like, you know, reflecting music as a metaphor for life. And I just think, like, for me, I loved sitting back and listening to this album with my eyes closed, because it was just such a visual and conceptual album. And as someone who has been a fan of hers from her 2006 debut Fern Gold, like, I have just really enjoyed, and I get so excited with each release, because she does offer so much, and she pushes so many boundaries conceptually and sonically.
So stars out of five from you, Zara.
I'm going to go for a 4.5.
4.5. And from you, Pat, I'm expecting a little less.
Well, can I just quickly say, I wasn't having a go at motherhood there. I have two daughters myself, and Kate Bush did an album called Ariel, where her son is playing in the garden, talking to birds and everything, and it's fantastic. So I just don't particularly like this record, that's all. Can I give it a generous 2?
Two and 4.5. That's for Bat for Lashes, The Dream of Delphi. Now, the next one is City, This City They Call You Love, from Richard Hawley, who was in the Olympic last week and has recorded a Louise Duffy special for the bank holiday at 12 noon on the bank holiday. So let's listen to this track. It's called Prism in Jeans.
There is an epic loneliness that you just can't hide. You just can't fit or belong, or to belong, to belong. She don't belong.
That's Prism in Jeans from Richard Hawley's new album, In This City They Call You Love. Pat, you had a great phrase. You said mighty mini operas like Scott Walker or Roy Orbison.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I don't remember saying that, but that's pretty good. Yeah, that's fair enough. I think the sound stretches back. Yeah, no, sorry, I do remember saying it. I would think I was talking about Roy Orbison. Stuff like It's Over by Roy Orbison, which has this voice that kind of wraps around you. And Hawley can do that. You mentioned that he played in the Olympia last weekend. I was at one of those shows and he did six or seven songs from this new album. And normally when you're at those kind of things and people do songs from the new album, you'll see a little noticeable migration out to the facilities.
Indeed.
But that didn't happen his stall. And he played, say, the title track from this, well, the kind of title track, the song where the title comes from, called People, which is a very gentle acoustic thing. And he played that as part of the encore.
This is in this city they call you love.
Yeah,
it's a phrase they say in Sheffield, yes.
And well, he prefaced the song by saying, in the city they call you love, but don't worry, they call you other things in Sheffield as well. But he played this song anyway, sorry, an acoustic, very gentle thing. And if a pin dropped, it would have sounded like a fire alarm. You know, it was fantastic. And this voice, what's he used to say about Mel Torme? The velvet fog, it kind of just wraps around you. For me, he can really do no wrong. I love all his records and I love this one as well. So now we'll hand over to the prosecution.
I think it does take you somewhere else. But back in time a bit, Zara, maybe?
Absolutely. And all of his reference points are reference points that I love. And I grew up listening to 60s music and even listening to Prism and Jeans. Immediately I thought of Eddie Cochran's Three Steps to Heaven. And also I thought of like the brighter Marty Robbins songs. And he actually, Richard Hawley in this, does do his own kind of murder ballad with Two for His Heels. And it's funny we mentioned like Scott Walker as well. That is their present, like Tis Night at the end reminded me of one of the more stripped back songs that you'd get on a Scott Walker solo album in the 60s, and actually Richard Hawley used one of Scott Walker's old guitars on this album. But for me, I was always quite a passive Richard Hawley fan. I remember when the song Tonight the Streets Are Ours came out from Ladies Bridge in 2007, and I was really swept up in it because it so beautifully had the strings and the 60s vibe. But this just to me, I kept finding with each song I was noting how flat things felt, how kind of unimaginative. Lyrically as well, I found some of the stuff a bit clunky. There's one line in particular that drove me up the wall when he sings, in my dreams, I always tell you that I dream about you in my dreams. But as Pat said, that's
you mean repetition.
Okay, that's not great.
It's a shame
because going back through his discography. No. I tried several times, but going over his discography, he does have the chops. He's a great voice. He's a great sense of musicality and a hook. And that song Pat mentioned, People, as I was listening to it, exactly what you described of that set, I could imagine that the crowd would be enthralled by that because it is a really compelling moment.
Okay, before we go further away from his mighty mini operas, let's listen to Oh Hi. Heavy Rain.
The ending of the world. No, I'm always thinking of you, girl. And all this heavy rain. Heavy rain. Here is where I.
That's Richard Hawley and Heavy Rain from In This City They Call You Love. That's the very one you don't like.
Just that one line. I do like the instrumentation of it. Like, it is really sumptuous and it's very difficult to not sway along with it. And I think that was just my issue with it. I know that Richard Hawley is a great artist. He's a great voice and I just expected more. And reading an interview with him leading up to this, he said that him and his band amassed 86 songs. And I just wondered, was there maybe other things there that would have suited something maybe more in that line? I did find those mellower moments I was more compelled towards.
All right, stars from you, Zara, for Richard Hawley.
It's a 2.5 because I know he can do better.
All right, God, that's even worse. The kicker was even worse than the score.
I can't even believe. I think I'm leaving. I can't even believe.
Yeah, come on, Pat. Give us, you'll have to make
I refuse,
up for the score.
I refute everything my colleague said in the last statement about Richard Hawley. I think this stuff is achingly romantic. Yes, it's a throwback to the 50s and all that, but that's what he does, and he does it better than anybody else. I would give this... I loved it. 4.5. And if I was allowed to give 5, I'd give 5. But I really liked it too.
All right. 4.5 and 2.5 for Richard Hawley, In This City They Call. Hall you love. Next we have Gravity Stairs from Crowded House, who will return to Ireland on the 23rd of June with a show at the Cork's Virgin Media Park. So Pat, you yeah. have recently interviewed them.
I have, yeah.
Now this is a whole family affair, two generations.
That's right, yeah. They got back together a few years ago, I think around, I don't know how long ago it was, after a layoff, and Niall Finn, who is the kind of main man, brought in his two sons, Liam and Elroy, and who are musicians already. I think it's, I'm not sure which one it is, has several solo albums out already. And they actually help out on the writing on this as well as playing along. And it just adds to a this lovely atmosphere. First of all, first and foremost, the most important thing with Crowded House has always been the songs. They have great songs. They're one of the great singles bands there is, full stop. And, you know, and that's not to ignore classic albums like Woodface and things like that. But this is just a beautiful record. They were talking, you know, as you said, I interviewed them, they were talking about getting together, recording it. He's sending around demos. Just a really nice family atmosphere. And I think it comes across on this. It really sounds
okay,
lovely to my ears, anyway.
Let's listen to Magic Piano from Crowded House. That's Magic Piano there from Gravity Stairs from Crowded House. So Don't Dream It's Over, Zara, Weather With You, all these famous tracks and singles that the Crowded House have had. Mm. Do you see Magic Piano in the same?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, as soon as I pressed play on this, because I was a bit like, okay, what are Crowded House going to sound like in 2024? Like, this could go one or two ways with a band approaching their 40th anniversary. And as soon as Magic Piano started, they sound so fresh. And in that song as well, like, the Gravity Stairs is a metaphor for getting older. And Niall Finn talking about how the stairs are kind of like a metaphor for, you know, climbing those stairs. If you're a bit older, it's a bit harder to get to the top, but he's pushing through. And sonically on this, I really could feel that he was really pushing, not like pushing himself. It didn't seem like he was exerting himself too much because it all seemed so effortless to him. Because as Ed O'Brien of Radio has described Niall Finn, he said he's the most prolific writer of great songs, and I can't dispute it. And across this album, there's so many great moments that just are so irresistible, so infectious, and have such a great palette of, like, that song reminded me a lot of the Beatles, Todd Rundgren. Later on as well, there's even, you know, later influences, kind of like the Coral or even Blur sometimes in some of the kind of motifs. So I thought this was a really nice, pleasant surprise.
Pat, were you happy with it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I thought it was great. As Zara said, from the minute you put it on, I mean, there's a line in that song there where he says, sometimes when you have something to say, words get in the way, let the melody reign. That's what he's all about.
And the generations merge together.
Yeah.
Or one generation is pushing the other to, like, be better.
I mean, when we talked about the generations, there's other things in this. There's a song about about Niall Finn's father during Second World War having a romance with some sort of an Italian countess. And then, for more generation stuff, one of the singles is called Teenage Summer, and it had a different title before his grandson. He was talking to his grandson on the phone, and the grandson said to Niall Finn, "Oh, I love that song, Teenage Summer." And he said, "Yeah, okay. If the kid says that's what it's called, that's what it's called."
So starts out of five from you, Zara.
I thought this was really fun. You can hear the fun that they had making it, and it's a 3.5 for me.
And from you, Pat?
It'll be the same as the Richard Hawley one. I loved this. I know,
and so
this
that's
is,
four
I know
and
this
a half.
old man stuff is aimed at me anyway. 4.5 pushing to 5. Yeah, I loved it. I thought
I'm
it was great.
So
I think it's their best one. I think it's their best one since Woodface, probably.
Okay, so that's Gravity Stairs from Crowded House. Much love by Zara and Pat. Lastly, we have Come As You Are from Niamh Regan. Her 2020 debut album, Hemet, led to nominations for both the RTÉ Folk Awards and the Choice Music Prize Album of the Year. Zara, refresh our memory on Niamh.
Yeah, so she's a Galway born singer-songwriter, and I think also as well in between had trained to become a teacher. She spent a lot of time in California and Galway, and it was through that time that she really worked on her songwriting, documenting her experiences. So with that, there's quite a nice intimacy to it. And with this album, she's expanded upon Hemet's kind of really nice folk leanings that have some kind of experimental electronic subtleties to it. And this has a full band with Tommy McLaughlin, who produced it with her. He's worked with Pillow Queens and Alvaretti. And I have to say, I adored their second album. It doesn't have any of that second album fear at all. To me, she sounds really artistically strong. And with the backing of that band, there was some references like Wilco in particular who kept springing to mind, and it wasn't in a she's ripping them off, she's really making this sound her own, and I was really, really impressed with this.
So we might play a record, and this features Soak on the track. That's Soak there, helping Niamh Regan out in the last track on the album, Record, from the album Come As You Are. So that's one of the collaborations on this, Pat. How do you think she works with other artists on
that particular song is very good, and when Soak comes in. But I mean, she doesn't really need anyone else, because I think this record is so strong on its own. Well, I was thinking as I was listening going along, there's a song, Paint You a Picture, where she talks about paint you a picture of a happy family. I could imagine Tammy Wynette singing that, you know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Nashville were on the phone to Niamh very soon for some of the songs in this. Great choruses, great hooks. One particular one I want to ask about is the opening track, Madonna. I mean, I'll be honest, I wasn't paying an awful lot of attention when I put this on. And then it just kind of caught me as it was going along. And I thought, and I think I've got the wrong end of the stick here altogether, that maybe this was a lyric about a father thinking about his daughter. And then I read an interview, and I think it's, and they said in the interview, so I don't know which is true, it's about violence against women, because they find her dead in the middle of the song. And I was sitting there listening to this and going, Janie Mac, what's going on here? It really just caught me. You know, I don't know what I was doing at the time, making a sandwich or something, but I forgot about the sandwich and paid attention to this record.
Yes, I think she sang that song for us in this very studio. And I remember going, what is this song about? Yeah, it caught me like that too. Yeah.
And there was other ones like that. Long Haul is a great song as well. Take It Easy could be Carole King. You know, like the voice, because it starts off and I thought, oh, not another Irish acoustic album, Janie Mac, I can't handle it. But it wasn't like that at all. This is a really, really, really strong record. Fantastic singing, subtle arrangements, and most importantly, just really great songs.
So you think this is a very good progression from the last album?
Absolutely. Right. And like that that song and that line that we're talking about in Madonna, like I found that in those moments when she's making a social commentary, and then even when she's kind of talking about some of the hardships in her personal and professional life, there's such a warmth to her that I felt really drawn to her, and I was really hanging on every word that she was saying. Like, I really loved spending time with her, and I think that there's such an earnestness in her vulnerability on this, but at the same time there's also a great lingering kind of weight of experience in her voice, which I just, for a second album as well, I find so impressive, and I'm really looking forward to what's next as well.
So stars from you, Zara, for Niamh Regan.
It's a strong 4 out of 5 for me.
And from you, Pat.
They'll think the fix is in. Myself and Zara are agreeing exactly. I will give it 4 out of 5 as well. It's a very good record. Very good.
So that's Niamh Regan's Come As You Are. And Zara Hederman and Pat Carty, thank you so much for listening to the records for us. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Niall Fitzmaurice, who sadly is moving on from Arena today. And we wish him very well. Aisling Grufferty was on sound here in Dublin, and John Doyle in Sligo. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.